Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We hear updates from journalist Dar Jamail this time as we take a break from state and national politics to focus on the war in Iraq. Our guest spent 8 months covering the war in 2003 and 2004, and at the time he was struggling to break stories in his home country of America about the way a brutal U.S. military program of arresting Iraqi men was having an impact on Iraqi public opinion. He then reported on torture in U.S.-run Iraqi prisons, the spiraling disaster of the U.S. military's operations from Baghdad to Fallujah. And since then, security has deteriorated to the point of open civil war, U.S. forces are once again pulling back, and the civilian death toll has been placed at 650,000 since the March invasion of 2003. The report was published by the British journal Lancet, which also reported on casualty statistics for the Balkan War. Last month, we heard reports of a U.S. and Iraqi plan to disarm death squad militias. Then, as that plan fell by the wayside, the mainstream press fell into a pattern of reporting grim statistics out of Baghdad, Balad, El Anbar province, and Baquba. But what about the role of U.S. and U.K. forces in all this? I asked Dar Jamail to explain America's role in the devastating militia activity going on in Iraq. He reported on the story for Interpress Service October 8th with Ali al-Fadili in Iraq.
There are a couple of key points in this article. One very important point, and this is something that I've been hearing reports from Iraqis for a long time now. Actually, we could say for over 6 months now, that when Shia militias that are basically, these are who populate the death squads in Iraq, as well as much of the Iraqi police and even some of the commandos coming out of the Interior Ministry of Iraq, the U.S. military has been reported by Iraqis to have been consistently allowing these people in through their checkpoints into different neighborhoods where the U.S. may have sealed a neighborhood, for example, like the predominantly Sunni al-Alamiyah neighborhood of Baghdad. And the Shia militiamen go in and are carrying out the detentions and oftentimes even the killings, and then leaving, all of this under the watchful eye of the U.S. military. And this continues to be reported as happening in Iraq, and not just in Baghdad, but in other cities as well, like in Ramadi or Samarra. Very, very troubling situation. It certainly appears as though the U.S. military is not only well aware of these Shia militias carrying out what they're doing, but in essence being complicit in it. Another piece of that article that I think is important is that there have been many reports now that the U.S. is backing a Sunni militia in Al Anbar province. This was a militia set up by sort of a renegade tribal leader who actually doesn't even live in the province anymore. He was ostracized from his tribe. This was an individual who actually tried to lead one of the Iraqi resistance groups. When he was chosen as not to be the leader, he basically defected to the other side and began collaborating with occupation authorities and actually lives in the green zone now. And under his watchful eye, he's been instrumental in helping set up a Sunni militia in Al Anbar with the hopes of the U.S. to start battling against the primarily Sunni resistance. So far, this hasn't really had success. There have been some men sign up for it for money. They will get arms, of course, and uniforms, but so far it really hasn't gone anywhere. His life's in great danger, which is why he has to live in the green zone now. And so far, this militia hasn't had any effect on battling the resistance. In fact, most of the people either haven't shown up or have immediately taken the arms and the money and defected. But the point is here, the important point is that the U.S. is backing militias on both sides. They're backing Sunni militias. They're backing several Shia militias, basically whenever it's convenient for them to use these militias to try to quell the resistance, then they'll back that militia no matter who they are or what side they're on or what kind of methods they use to carry out their work.
Talk about the reasons that the U.S. military and U.S. government might support two opposing militias in Iraq, and also talk about the efforts underway for partitioning of Iraq.
The partitioning is favored by some of the Shia, not all of the Shia. For example, there is a large block of Shia that do favor it because a strong federal state in the south where there's massive oil deposits, they're pretty keen to that. And plus, to put some distance between them and the middle of Iraq, which is where right now the majority of the bloodshed is taking place. The Kurds, of course, are in favor of this as well because they're making moves daily to go independent. Daily they get closer and closer to trying to attain total independence, and of course they have massive oil deposits up there as well. The Sunnis are very much against it, as well as actually Muqtada al-Sadr is very much against partitioning Iraq, and he has millions of followers. So the Shia are split. We need to be clear on that, because in most mainstream outlets they portray it as though the Shia are unified and very much want federalism, that basically everyone's in favor of it except for the Sunnis, because they're bickering because they're now out of power. It's not that simple. The reality is that I think the U.S. is very much in favor of it. There's documented evidence that as far back as the mid-70s, Henry Kissinger was talking about dividing Iraq into three, possibly even four, possibly even more than that, different small sort of rump states, because it would be in the benefit of Israel. It would be easier to control these smaller states instead of having one unified Iraq. And so it is clear that the neocons in this administration are in favor of it. You have people like ex-Secretary of State James Baker talking about that, yes, this would be maybe a good thing, which is the great irony, because we have this administration that has gone out of its way to talk about how Iraq is sovereign, it is an independent country now, and yet you have sort of the stooge of the Bush administration or the fixer of the Bush administration, James Baker, now talking about, well, maybe we should divide it. Well, what business is it of his to make any call that would affect Iraq in any way whatsoever, let alone talking about dividing up the country when he's not even technically in the U.S. government anymore? I think that makes very clear where the U.S. stands on this, that this administration is very much in favor of dividing up Iraq, but internally inside of Iraq, we could say that it's very, very extremely contentious issue, if not the biggest issue right now facing this struggling, fragmented government, even though most of it's a puppet government. And, you know, how this gets resolved is going to weigh extremely heavily on what the future is going to look like in that country.
I think going back to the initial setting up of the Iraqi government, ministries, and then militias, people have wondered just how independent they are from U.S. control. But going back to partitioning, let's say the Sunni would get a portion of Iraq. Is it possible that the American government and military are trying to buy their way into a bit of power in that event and gain control by supporting a Sunni militia at this level? Or is that too cynical?
No, I think actually the point of it is control, that in order to control the oil, the production, how much is coming out, the price fixing, it's going to be a lot easier for the people in this administration and, more importantly, the people backing them, i.e. the Halliburtons, the oil companies, etc., to control the oil if they have it split up into different sections, rather than trying to get something resembling consensus out of a government in Baghdad regarding what would happen to Iraq's oil. Well, now we only have to deal with a portion of the Shia population in the south, a small representative portion at that, to talk about that oil and the oil, the massive oil fields down around Basra, and then same with the north in Kurdistan, which actually there are Kurdish authorities already making deals with foreign companies about oil up there, and they're making it without even the okay from Baghdad. So it's already beginning to happen in some places. But I think it is basically about control of the oil, about economic resources, and then also about trying to control and isolate the resistance. I think that I'm sure one of the perspectives of people, planners in this administration, is that if we can isolate the resistance in the middle and then have the Shia police their own areas in the south once we get the oil deals cut, and the same with the Kurds in the north, then we just have to deal with central Iraq, and that would make it a bit easier for the military and maybe even allow them to withdraw some of the troops.
Turning now to your October 9th piece in Interpress Service with Ali Al-Fadili, you wrote that an unknown city was erupting, and that was Baquba.
This is a story about a mixed city. Baquba, it's about 30 miles northeast of Baghdad, and it essentially highlights the fact that despite the fact that it's received almost no reporting, which is why the title of the piece was An Unknown City, that should have been in quotes, actually, of the unknown, because it's very well known for those of us who've worked in Iraq that this has been a very, very contentious city. There's been very strong resistance there. One day it's in control of the U.S. military. The next day it's in control of the resistance. Maybe the next day it's in control of various militias. People there, there's so much violence and so much fighting every day, they don't really know from one day to the next who's in control of it and what might happen. But basically what's been going on there more recently is that, again, some of these U.S.-backed Shia militias have gone through and detained a very, very large number of people, sparking off massive uproar across the city. People are very angry at the tactics being used. They're very angry that from one day to the next, they don't know if some of their loved ones are going to be detained and put in some detention facility somewhere, and then who knows what being done to them. So it's a very, very volatile city. It's very mixed, as I said. It's about half Shia and half Sunni, where there wasn't any sectarian problems before the invasion, but now it's become a very, very huge issue, and most people there do believe it's because the U.S. has sort of forced that issue and drawn the line and made people take sides, depending on whether they're Shia or Sunni.
Where you talk about the disappearance of the U.S. Army, that's metaphorical, too, because the Army has disappeared from the headlines in terms of civilian casualties or other casualties in Iraq. We've seen stories from Reuters recently, 60 bodies found in Iraq at one time. People are reporting and using the terms torture, using the terms death squad. But the U.S. Army is no longer being mentioned as near this violence, even as U.S. military casualty reports are also up.
Well, this is when I think that we need to cite the results of the new Johns Hopkins University study that was published in The Lancet yesterday, that basically when it comes to tabulating civilian casualties, this is one of the only scientific studies to have been done throughout the entire occupation to document the level of carnage. And the mean number that they say the casualty figure result they came up with their survey is as many as 655,000 people. And that's basically splitting the difference between their low-end number, which was 400,000 dead, and then their high-end number, which is around 800,000 dead. So they basically... it's a little over 800, actually. It's closer to 890,000 as their high-end number. And so they basically split the difference, and then that's the figure they released to the press. It's a very interesting study. I would encourage everyone to read it in full as far as their very, very sound methodology that they use to tabulate this figure. And then what they say as far as the possibility of it even being higher than the top-end number that they cite. But the Iraqi figures, anything coming from the Iraqi government, which is why, of course, Mr. Bush, when questioned about this number yesterday, said that, of course, the U.S. government and the Iraqi government don't agree with that figure. Well, that depends on who you ask in the Iraqi government, because, of course, the pro-U.S. Puppets that are in this government are, of course, going to say, no, that's too high of a figure. But then if you ask some of the lower-down people, actually doctors and morgue workers, people running the graveyards, the people that actually are counting the bodies, then they are going to tell you, yes, that number is accurate, and that's what I saw myself when I was on the ground in Iraq. I went to many morgues myself, many, many hospitals, talked with many doctors in different cities, and all of them were saying the same thing, that we simply cannot keep up with the level of bodies that are coming in here. And granted, this was in February 2005. So at that point, that was before the bombing of the Shia shrine in Samarra. That was long before the carnage got anywhere near the level that it is today. And it was already off the chart. So I think we need to pay very close attention to this, the results of this scientific study that just highlights the level of carnage in Iraq, because Iraqi authorities, and especially in a war zone, they're really just not equipped to really argue with that number. And in fact, most of the people I've been in touch with in Iraq since that figure was released do agree that they think, yeah, that sounds more like the level of carnage that we're talking about here, despite what the U.S. government or, of course, the puppet Iraqi government might say about it.
I see in your October 12 piece, Resistance Growing Up at School, that young people have a lot of anger towards America, and that a headmaster at one of the schools explained that the resistance won't stop until the last American leaves. What's your sense of the way the latest types of casualties are seen by the Iraqis? Do they see U.S. responsibility in what the Iraqi ministries or militias or death squads are doing?
That's right. People are holding primarily the U.S. military responsible for all of the carnage, although now, as the study pointed out, whereas when the first Lancet study was done, the military was found responsible for 86% of all the carnage. In this one, they're finding the U.S. military responsible for 31%. The primary reason for that is that militias and death squads have started generating far more casualties than the U.S. military. That doesn't mean the U.S. military is killing less people. That means they're still killing the same number of people as they were when the first survey was done, which is an astronomical amount of people. But that means that the level of violence from the militias and the death squads is so great that it has surpassed even the numbers generated by the U.S. military. But people hold the United States responsible for this. Let me give you an example. I was speaking with a sheikh in Bakuba, and I asked him, this was quite a ways back, and I asked him, well, should the U.S. military withdraw from Iraq? I mean, what do you think the problem is, or do you think that they should stay here and try to help calm the situation, maybe try to help with reconstruction and such before they leave? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, when someone is stabbed with a knife, do you start treating the wounds first and then pull out the knife? No, of course not. First you pull out the knife. And that is how most Iraqis view this. They see that even though now with the militias generating the highest number of bodies than any other entity in Iraq, that this never happened until the invasion and occupation began. This never happened until the U.S. came in and have done in that country what they've done. And so they hold them to blame even when it is now militias that are generating more of the numbers. And me and my colleague in Iraq have found that so many children now are so anti-American. You know, this was a very troubling trend that I saw even over a year ago when I was in Iraq, that people used to make that distinction between the policies of the government and the American people, but now that line is blurred and people really aren't making that distinction any longer, and especially children. It's really hard to convince a kid in Fallujah that all Americans aren't bad people when all he's known is 3.5 years of death and suffering, and half or all of his family members have been killed, and all he sees is soldiers and tanks rolling down his streets, and he's scared for his life on a daily basis. It's pretty difficult to convince that child that all Americans aren't that way.
Dar Jamail, you covered torture at Abu Ghraib and in other U.S.-run detention centers in Iraq, and you saw the consequences firsthand in some of the stories that you wrote. We've been reporting on the progress of the so-called torture bill, the Military Commissions Act just signed by the president. I want to ask you first, is torture still going on in Iraqi prisons? And also, what impact do you think that the Military Commissions Act might have on the difficulties that have been faced by tens of thousands of Iraqis that have been arrested and detained without access to any legal protections?
Well, that law, I think, will have absolutely zero impact on what's going on in Iraqi prisons run by the U.S. military. And it's very easy to answer the question regarding what's happening in those detention camps. It's the same thing that's always been happening, that there's been virtually no change. Abu Ghraib was basically just a snapshot of U.S. prison policy in Iraq, and it has not stopped. Yes, the U.S. military turned over Abu Ghraib to be run by Iraqi authorities, so that just means they've outsourced the torturing just like they've been doing with these CIA extraordinary rendition flights, shipping people to places like Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia, go on down the list, Eastern European countries, to be tortured, and this is all very, very well documented. So they're starting to do that in Iraq now, for example, by catching a member of the Sunni resistance and putting him in a prison that's controlled by a Shia militia. Well, you can imagine what's going to happen to that individual. But the same thing is still going on. There are many other U.S.-run detention facilities in that country. It's really not changed at all since Abu Ghraib. People are still coming out of those detention facilities talking about being tortured, electrodes placed on their genitalia, being cut, beaten, starved, frozen, kept in isolation for months at a time. All of the same stuff is going on, the sexual humiliation. The thing is, the military has just made sure that they've, as few people as possible, are still going in there with their personal digital cameras and taking their war glory photos, which is essentially how that first scandal came to light when 60 Minutes 2 ran their profile on it in early May 2004. But don't be fooled by the way that the military handled that situation. This type of treatment is ongoing. In fact, it is policy in Iraq, and it shouldn't come as a surprise when we have people like Alberto Gonzalez, our so-called attorney general, who's arguing publicly in even the mainstream media for the use of torture and arguing against the Geneva Convention, and at times even arguing against parts of the U.S. Constitution. So when we have a U.S. attorney general publicly advocating the use of torture, you can imagine what's being done in U.S. detention facilities in Iraq.
Dar, I want to ask you about a specific story we've been working on about three-term Republican incumbent Rob Simmons here in Connecticut's 2nd District. He and Democrat Joe Courtney are running neck and neck in the 2006 race. Now, we've been airing portions of what Rob Simmons told author Douglas Valentine, who interviewed him for his book, The Phoenix Program. And we've been talking about the way Simmons has been defending the White House and also the CIA on historical issues like torture, domestic spying, and assassination. We noticed that back on May 28th, USA Today's Andrea Stone wrote about the struggle Simmons and other Republicans were having over Iraq and the Abu Ghraib scandal. And in her piece, she described the congressman as, quote, a former Army intelligence officer who observed prisoner interrogations in Vietnam. Now, in a phone conversation, Andrea Stone confirmed that this was how Rob Simmons had characterized his work in Indochina and his status there, specifically that he observed interrogations for the Army. Just to clear up a point, Rob Simmons was in Vietnam for the CIA, and he didn't just observe prisoner interrogations for the Army. He ran one of the CIA's province interrogation centers, and he did interrogations himself, as we've heard in his own words during interviews with Douglas Valentine. Now, he also spoke with an author named Mark Moyer, and I want to read some of what he told that more apologetic writer who wrote about the Phoenix program of the CIA. Yet there on page 105 was Rob Simmons' own admission that he had violated the Geneva Conventions. Simmons told Mark Moyer that when detainees were wounded, he would bring in American doctors who would examine them and offer their medical opinion that the wound was so bad that his prisoner might lose a limb. The detainees would ask the CIA man, what can you do? And he told Moyer, quote, I'd usually let the doctor go and then tell the prisoner, we'd like to help, but it's hard to get the medicine. I can't do anything to help you without getting some sort of help in return. That tended to work well, Simmons said. Now, many of these were just simple Vietnamese peasants dragged in and described as Viet Cong because that's the way the war was, and that's the way that program was. So it's very much like the story of what happened at Abu Ghraib. Between 70% and 90% of those detainees were innocent civilians arrested by mistake, according to the Red Cross. Dar, you say torture is continuing in Iraq. Rather than pass legislation to ban it altogether, we see that the Bush administration and members of Congress like Rob Simmons have actually legalized it under the Military Commissions Act. Now, the press has been led on this subject in the same way that they were led about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And when you and I spoke about torture back in 2003, as you told listeners, there was a specific case of a man who had been tortured to a state of coma. Now, was he denied medical treatment? I mean, do you think that there are any similarities to what you've just heard about what this congressman and others probably in the CIA did in Vietnam?
But Dory, this is a story that actually you and I spoke about on the radio a long, long time ago. When I was in Iraq, there was just a specific case in point of an individual by the name of Sadiq Zolman, who I found and then reported to you that had been tortured quite brutally by the U.S. military. And then there was an army medic who was complicit in that by trying to hide the fact that he was tortured in a medical report because he was tortured into a coma. So despite the fact that Zolman had very, very distinct electrical burn marks on the bottoms of his feet and on his genitals and bruises up and down his body and the back of his head being bashed in, none of that made the medical report of this Army lieutenant who wrote it up. And in that way, along with the fact that there are Army medics in Iraq to this day that are being complicit in torture, either by A, not reporting it, like the instance I just cited, or by B, literally going in and monitoring it. They do that by going in while someone's being interrogated, i.e. tortured, and say, well, this person can hold out a little bit longer so you can keep going. And that sounds frightfully similar to a particular individual there in this race, and I as a technique that they used in Vietnam. And that's policy. That's why we have it being repeated today. It's why it happened in Vietnam. It's not just because people get creative and come up with this on their own. It's because it's policy. And when we have people running for office in this country who have A, practiced that, and B, haven't come out very clearly against it today, then that's a big problem. And it's top down. When we have an attorney general that's publicly arguing for the use of torture, then of course we're going to have people trying to get into positions of elected representatives who also abide by that policy.
Dar Jamil writes for Interpress Service and many other publications, including The Nation, Alternet. You can read a compilation of his work online at darjamilirak.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, radio for the people at UConn, the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. and TalkNation.org or TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion.